Retina Rounds, podcast number 7. To wrap up our week of pediatric vitreoretinal surgery, we're delighted to welcome Dr. Aaron Nagel. As many of you have seen through the videos he has shared with us, Dr. Nagel is an extremely talented and innovative surgeon. During this podcast, we'll get to learn more about Dr. Nagel's career path, what drew him to pediatric retina, his thoughts on the future of gene therapy, how to learn new skills as a surgeon, and his pearls as a medical educator. Let's check it out. Welcome, everyone. I want to introduce our guest today on Retina Rounds, Dr. Aaron Nagel. Dr. Aaron Nagel is the Assistant Professor of Ophthalmology at the Roski Eye Institute at USC and is the Chief of Retina at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. He has been our guest surgeon for the past week and shared with us a number of really interesting cases. We've all had a chance to learn a lot about pediatric vitreoretinal surgeries, and we've been able to learn some new techniques also that can be applied even to adult patients. So thank you, Aaron, for joining us. It's really great to have you.
It's wonderful to be part of this wonderful platform, especially coming from you and Steve, who I adore greatly. So thank you again for having me on this week.
It's our pleasure. So tell us a little bit about your path, Aaron. I mean, you're sort of had this meteoric rise in your career since you finished fellowship, but it obviously didn't start in fellowship. You had a lot of groundwork leading up to your post-fellowship life. And so tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I can say that I've been fortunate in that I kind of knew what I wanted to do at a very early age. So I always knew I wanted to be a doctor. And then I realized I wanted to kind of be that physician scientist, you know, hybrid track pretty early in college. And I wasn't even thinking about ophthalmology, but I ended up in a neuroscience lab for my PhD at Rockefeller. And that's where I really got interested in the retina and neuroscience, especially how these sensory organs, including the retina, develop and how you get diseases from genetic mutations and other things like that. And so believe it or not, it was during my PhD, I thought I should do pediatric retina, which is like nobody even thinks about that. Even people who are in retina, it's like the last thing they could ever think of doing. But that's what I wanted to do. So my first contact was with Paul Chan, who was the pediatric retina specialist at Cornell at the time. I mean, I had a meeting with him. It was my first contact ever with anyone in ophthalmology. And he heard I'm from Southern California. And in the first 5 minutes, he set me up with a summer rotation with Tom Lee, who is still with us here at Children's, doing pediatric retina. And he was like, you should go do a summer thing with him. And I did that, and I loved it. And then, of course, you know, I trained at UCLA for residency and fellowship under you and Steve and others, wonderful mentors, knowing full well that I kind of was leaning towards pediatric retina in a position like that. And, you know, I continued my conversations with Tom throughout those years, and everything just lined up for me to go there. And they kind of set me up really nicely to have this kind of boutique practice in pediatric retina, and allow me to also have laboratory research. And it was happened to be just at the time when Luxturna was about to be approved. And so they're already looking for surgical sites. And we had, CHLA had secured a spot to be the surgical site. So I already kind of knew things would be like, you know, fertile ground for me to establish my career.
Incredible. So actually an introduction after a 5 minute conversation with Dr. Chan, and that just set you up for the rest of your life. I mean, or at least to this point. It's incredible.
Exactly.
Wow.
Little things like that can make a big difference.
It really can, right? I mean, throughout our lives, these small, you know, seemingly insignificant interactions can really make a huge difference. And it really speaks to the power of networking and really meeting people. And you never know which kind of doors are going to open. And of course, we have to walk through those doors when they do open. But it's really the basis for so many professional careers.
Totally.
So, you know, after fellowship, what I was always really impressed with is that you didn't stop learning. You actually continued to grow your surgical skill set. including learning how to perform endoscopic vitrectomy, amongst other surgical techniques. So tell me a little bit about how you endeavored to do that, and maybe some tips also for other vitreoretinal surgeons, regardless of where they are in their career, if they want to add on maybe some significant new surgical techniques.
Right, yeah. Well, one of the things I love about pediatric retina is that I'm always getting challenged in some way. There's just so many unique situations, unique cases. So I never feel like I stop learning. I'm still learning, even if I'm doing a quote unquote standard technique like a vitrectomy. Things are always different based on the size of the eye. The anatomy can be different. There can be different comorbidities, and so it kind of keeps me on my feet. So I've always enjoyed that, but. I think that we should all kind of, I think we grow and we improve ourselves by kind of challenging ourselves and kind of going down routes that we may not have gone down. In some ways, it's a necessary thing, right? We're always going to have, there's always going to be new techniques for the things that we learned, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago in fellowship. And it behooves us to kind of like keep on top of that, of course, right? And kind of be the best kind of retina specialist we can be. But sometimes it puts us in a kind of like an uncomfort zone. And I would encourage all of us to kind of think outside the box when you're faced with a certain kind of clinical or surgical situation and not be afraid to kind of go down a route that you haven't been or nobody's been down. When it's justified and when you feel like that, there's a good potential upside and ideally a little downside, because you could potentially make a big impact on that.
No, for sure. I mean, it really speaks to lifelong learning, and you're right. It's not just about book learning. The amount of scientific information and how our field has evolved even over the course of the last 5 to 10 years has been tremendous, and it'll continue to grow exponentially, but also surgically. Really kind of challenging ourselves to embrace new technologies. Definitely, the way that we will operate 10 years from now will not be the same as the way that we operate today. And so keeping that thirst for wanting to grow, I think, is really important for retina specialists of all ages, really. But one of the things that I think sometimes I personally think about, and I'm sure others do, is if you've got a technique that works for you, right, and the outcomes are good, it can sometimes be a little bit scary to try something different, right? Because at the end of the day, we just want the best for our patients, and so trying something new isn't just about our own interest of wanting to expand our surgical repertoire, but also wanting to give our patients the absolute best outcome. So, let's just talk specifically about endoscopic vitrectomy, for example. So I think that's a situation where it's really born out of necessity to try to learn these types of new techniques. So tell us about some of your first cases and how you actually developed that skill set.
It was something that my mentor Tom Lee had been doing for years. Honestly, on many cases that you and I and many others would never even consider doing in that way. We just do a regular top-down approach. It's just faster, easier. We're used to it. It kind of forced me to think like, okay, wow, I guess, this technique could be used in other situations. And of course, sometimes, as sometimes when you need it, you need it. Like you have a bad cornea, you have a, trauma eye, something like that, and you want to use it. And the last thing you want is to be, on your first few cases of endoscopic vitrectomy for a, terrible looking eye. And it's just going to be very confusing and difficult to manage. So what happened with me actually is I kind of forced myself to use it almost on every case, in part because we had a bad microscope when I first started that couldn't record video, and I could record off the endoscope, and I just wanted to record my cases, so I thought I'd just do endoscopic. And just going through the motions of doing, relatively kind of routine cases that you normally wouldn't do with the endoscope, for example, silicone oral removal or a vitreous hemorrhage or a lensectomy, doing it with the endoscopic approach, got me to the point where, I had the muscle memory and kind of understood kind of how things worked enough that now I would say I use it a lot less, but at least I have it kind of at the ready in cases where I need it. So it does require, there is that pain. I mean, like, as you know, just going through our medical training, you start a new rotation, you don't know anything, and you just have to like gain experience. There's no way to just buy that. Same thing with new techniques. It's like you just have to like kind of muscle through it. And it's a pain. I mean, things take longer, there's more setup, you're not used to it. But there is a benefit on the other side, when you know that you know how to do another technique, and can employ it as needed.
Thinking about how our trainees learn just the basics of vitreoretinal surgery, right? They're usually starting by reading. They're usually starting by watching videos. They may there may be some didactics in their training. Is that some are those some of the things that you started with as well, or did you have somebody with you for your first endoscopic case? How did you do
Yeah.
that?
Yeah. So I watched Tom do several, and then he was there for me for my first few, and then occasionally after that, if there was like, a tricky case like a ROP detachment or something, I would kind of get him to come. So I think that's important. We can maybe talk about that later for, pediatric retina fellowship or mentorship. That was important for me because it's something that it's nice to have someone who can kind of get in there to kind of give you some tips and pointers, even though at the end of the day, the point I make with endoscopic vitrectomy is that it's still vitrectomy. We're still doing the same things. It's just wrapping your brain around the different viewing angle, and understanding what you're seeing and how to avoid some of the pitfalls that come along with it. But other than that, it's not like you need to. It's not like a new technique. It's not like doing cornea surgery or something. It's still VR surgery.
Right. I mean, maybe not to the same extent, but sort of like transitioning from a microscope to a heads-up display. Obviously, endoscopic surgery carries with it a lot of other challenges, but just kind of getting familiar with just a different way of approaching the same problem.
Yeah.
What about going forward? Are there certain techniques that you're interested in continuing to add, or maybe new techniques that you think need to be developed?
Just in VR surgery in general.
And in pediatrics specifically.
Oh, well, there's always a need for kind of better, I think, IOL techniques. It's something that doesn't come up as often in pediatric retina, all these kind of secondary IOL, sutured or unsutured fixated lenses. In part because, sometimes they're not candidates for lenses either because they have self trauma or their eyes just can't, tolerate it for whatever reason. Or, a lot of times, at least for me, I'm very conservative and I'll, if both eyes are getting lenses removed, I'll just leave them aphakic and they wear glasses and they're happy. But the issue with kids is, is that, they're going to have this lens that's fixated in a, semi-stable way. And they have a whole life to live and they're active and so on. And, maybe things that we can, issues like dislocation and so on that are not such a big deal in a 10-year time frame or a bigger deal in the 30 or 40-year time frame. So I wish we had a little bit better techniques or intraocular lenses that were more suitable for kind of broad use. I was excited to see Frank Brody's presentation at Veil Vitrectomy. With this kind of artificial capsule that could potentially work in any eye, and totally takes out the headache of these different techniques in a way, and could be a great option for these patients, but those are the kind of the main issues. Then the other one is, an issue that we face in adults as well, which is PVR. Kids have a pretty strong kind of inflammatory, scarring, fibrotic reaction, probably more so than adults, in some ways. And so that's an issue. And of course, people have made some progress on methotrexate and other modalities, but they're not, doing a weekly injection on a 6-year-old of methotrexate is not exactly like a super feasible thing. If you're putting at least a sedation room or some sort of other setup. So, I wish we had some kind of better technique or better way to kind of mitigate that, intraoperatively in some way.
Yeah, actually, the PVR risk was something that was really interesting to me because in some of the cases that you presented this past week, actually a PVD wasn't induced. And the teaching has always been, you've got to get the posterior hyoid up or else that's going to contract and there's going to be retinal detachment, especially in younger patients. I would assume that there would be a high risk for PVR, but that's not always the case in pediatric retina. So some of the sort of quote unquote rules of adult vitreoretinal surgery don't necessarily apply in pediatrics.
Yeah, well, in part it's because the risk there's the risk benefit of the PVD induction, which can essentially, rules it out entirely if you're going to risk creating retinal break making the PVD, or it's just impo physically impossible to do. And as we know with tractional detachments, if you lyse the tractional vectors, the retina wants to reattach and it'll do so. But yeah, it's a little bit unconventional thinking. I think the caveat is we're not seeing the PVD happen in our lifetime as pediatric retina specialists. These patients are going to become adults and move on. But they could, as adults, end up getting a PVD later in life and end up with other vitreoretinal complications. So these do end up being kind of lifetime diseases for the eyes. So just because you went in and fixed a stage 4 ROP as a child, doesn't mean they can't have retinal detachments later, from the PVR. But it's true that we don't tend to, for example, like a Marfan lensectomy, I won't necessarily induce a PVD. I mean, I often will try, but I'll just leave it if it looks too difficult and just kind of shave down the vitreous as cleanly as possible. And remove the capsule entirely, and the patients tend to do well.
That's great. And so you mentioned training fellows. That's a huge part of, being in academics, although, that can happen on all kinds of settings, teaching younger physicians and surgeons. Certainly a part of the job that brings you and I a lot of joy. So tell me a little bit about your fellowship program, how the fellows interact with you. And you mentioned mentorship earlier. So tell us a little bit about the importance of mentorship when it comes to pediatric retina.
I think the fellows like rotating with me at Children's just because they see different things. I mean, these are weird eyes, just like more difficult surgeries, not your typical bread and butter. So that's always exciting for them. But that does bring up questions of fellow involvement and how what's acceptable for a fellow to do and how to kind of like build up their confidence in a safe way. So just like many programs, including UCLA, we do have the counting system. So the fellows have pretty much full autonomy when I'm there and I'm staffing the cases when they're over there. It's their case. I'll often scrub in, but I won't necessarily do anything the whole case aside from assist, unless they need me to. And Children's, of course, it's a different kind of situation. These are pediatric eyes. And so, as you've probably encountered, a lot of times fellows just kind of want to go in and do like A to Z, like start the case and start to finish. And that's not necessarily the most feasible thing to just like walk in and just try to do the whole thing. I mean, maybe it's possible, but it would be painful and long. So what I try to do is give them defined portions to do and then build out from there. So, for simple examples like ROP lasers, I don't just say, okay, here, laser the retina and then I'll see what's happening. I laser the difficult parts, usually the nasal, superior, inferior, leave the temporal quadrant, which is usually most accessible and easiest to see. And I'll even demarcate a box where the laser is along the ridge and then lasers at the aorta, so they know they just need to fill in the square or the rectangle. And we'll start with that because then they kind of get their bearings and they see how to, because the pediatric eyes are different, they're kind of softer and you get more kind of astigmatism, distortion sometimes if you're not used to it. And then we'll build out from there and then they can just kind of like do the temporal quadrant and then do other areas as well, rather than just letting them kind of get flustered maybe. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is I try to encourage them to have to not just when they're watching me during doing surgery, not just kind of like sit there and assist, but also kind of every step kind of critically analyze in their brains, like, what is going on? What is he doing? What's different about it? Because I've had several examples where I do things in a certain way and I'm telling them that. And then when I have them take over and I say, okay, do it the way we've been doing it for the last, 20 cases. And they're like, what do you mean? Like it wasn't registering. So I think that's important. Even though fellows, of course, want to do hands-on for the most part, and that is important. It is also important as you're observing to kind of register what you're seeing and see how it fits into what you're doing and what's different about it, and kind of make mental notes, because I think you learn a lot from that. And then the last thing, which I definitely learned in my fellowship, is just preparedness. Getting there early, setting up the microscope with the patient, with the oculars. I can't tell you how many times like the screws are loose on the Lumera, or oculars are messed up, or the video recording's not working, or something like that. And it's just a general sense of preempting and having full control, situational awareness of what's happening in the room. So it's not just the microscope, which is on us, but also just watching the staff, making sure, are they prepping the eye correctly? Are they setting up the machine correctly? There's often a sense in fellowship, maybe because you're not like the ultimate authority in the room, to just kind of like walk in and do whatever you're supposed to do. But it's good to start getting in the habit of also, making sure everything else is running smoothly, so that people are setting up things right. Because you get a new scrub tech, or someone takes a break and someone takes over, and then something gets messed up or not set up correctly, and that can set you back, not just time-wise, but also, safety-wise sometimes. So just kind of teaching them that like situational awareness. But that's sometimes some of the hardest things to teach, because there's nothing you can directly instruct them on. It's just something that you try to get their eyes and ears more focused on what they should be paying attention to.
Yeah, those are outstanding tips. So for educators, having very specific predefined goals, right?
Right.
And then building from there. And I think the more specific and the more directed one can be when teaching the fellows and residents and students in general, the better. Because if you just tell them to do something but don't give them really specific guardrails or specific instructions, it can be difficult because they don't know what they don't know. The second thing, I love the idea of just always being inquisitive, right? It doesn't matter what situation trainees are in, if they're always thinking and always asking questions, guess what? That not only makes them better, it makes you as a surgeon better, right? I'm sure you've been asked questions by a fellow or somebody else, a student, and you're like, oh, I've never really thought about that before, right? I mean, has that ever risen to the point where it's actually kind of changed the way that you do things, or maybe inspired a new idea or a new surgical approach?
Yeah, sometimes you're just used to doing things your way, and then they'll say, oh, why don't you do it this way? And you realize, oh, that could work as well, or that could work better. And of course, sometimes fellows will teach me things that they've seen from other, faculty, and so that's always welcome. But yeah, I find that some of the best fellows are the ones who are always asking questions like, why are you doing it this? Why are you doing that? Because it shows they're thinking.
Right.
They're incorporating what they're seeing into like their kind of knowledge base, and really like analyzing critically, instead of just kind of sitting there passively, just watching.
Right. And it doesn't have to be for the trainees who are listening. It doesn't have to be in real time. It could be an internal dialogue, and then maybe at the end of the case, you can ask these types of questions. Or even in clinic, there are times our mutual mentor, Dr. Krieger, there's so many times where I was just watching him and the way that in clinic, for example, just the way that he would interact with patients. And he just seemed to have this sort of uncanny way of just knowing how a patient was feeling, how to allay their concerns. And so, as I was absorbing that after the fact, sort of ask him a little bit more about his approach and how his clinical approach evolved. And so it can extend from the clinic all the way to the operating room. And then finally, your point about being prepared, I think, is really important for the trainees out there who are listening. I think not only does it make you better as a surgeon, you have to review the imaging, you have to examine the patient if you can, at least make every effort to examine the patient, know the imaging, know the patient backwards and forwards. And guess what? When you demonstrate that level of knowledge to your attending, they're far more interested in getting you more involved in the case because it shows a certain level of diligence and a certain level of caring that that we want to see in all of our fellows.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. So, one of the things that's as kind of thinking about Dr. Krieger there for a second and managing the patients and their concerns, your job is more difficult because not only do you have to take care of a sick child, but you also have to help the very anxious, I'm sure, parents of a sick child. So, tell us a little bit, that sort of role of the physician of being a healer and not just the physical healer, but also sort of emotionally being involved with the patient and family is amplified in pediatrics, I think. And so tell us a little bit about your approach and kind of any tips that you have for ophthalmologists in general to incorporate that into their own practice.
I think with the kids, it really depends on their age. I try to, when appropriate, really involve them in the conversation. Once they're kind of maybe older than 12 years of age, usually like they're sitting on exam chair on one end, and the parents are sitting in the chairs on the other end of the exam room. And it's very easy to just talk to the parents about surgery and this and that, and the kids sitting there understanding everything, and I'm not even looking at them. And I always feel bad about that, and I think that they deserve to kind of hear it as well, maybe in more child-directed kind of way, because that creates a lot of anxiety for them when they're hearing all this stuff and I'm just ignoring them. And I'm still guilty of it, but I try to really make sure they're kind of in the conversation together with the parents so that they kind of feel like, I'm addressing their concerns and anxieties. And sometimes as soon as I just tell them, oh, you'll be asleep during the whole surgery and you just wake up with an eye patch without any pain, they're happy, but they have no idea what surgery means. They could, for all they know, they could be awake and it hurts and all this stuff. So I think it's important to kind of have still keep a patient-centered approach, even though it's really the parents who are consenting for it. And then in terms of the parents, it's I think it's similar to, like you said, just having a nice rapport with them and kind of addressing their concerns. As you recall, Dr. Krieger would sit down and make a drawing for patients to kind of, that just goes a long way, just sitting down and showing them the anatomy and showing that you care and taking the time to do that instead of like, oh, we're going to do this and that and move along, next patient. So that's really helpful. But one of the things that, as you know, is trickier is that these are parents and they're anxious and this is their child. And so you have to strike the balance between having no hope. Like, some of these cases are kind of honestly hopeless. They're very difficult. There's very poor prognosis, and we're just trying our best to like even just get some like bare light perception or even preserve their light perception or their hand motion so that they can navigate in a room, and that's a big deal for them. So it's important regardless, I think, to just keep some hope for the parents. I think it's devastating when we might speak in kind of more doctorly terms about what's going on. And so it's not to kind of lie to the families, but kind of couch it in a way that provides like some hope or some glimmer of hope, because I think everybody needs that. It's hard to live with knowing that everything is just like hopeless and terrible. So I try to always have kind of a little bit of a silver lining on whatever's going on while still being truthful. Sometimes I see The trainees will talk in front of the families about the situation, and they'll just kind of use doctor terms, first of all, which can be very scary to families because they don't know all these terms, what we're saying. They sound very, serious and bad. So I try to encourage our fellows to kind of like either tone it down or, we can talk later, kind of more of the details, talk shop like separately. Or if there's anything like that's kind of like concerning for sure, like just don't mention it in front of them. Because again, it's like, just saying they have like a vitreous separation or a vitreous detachment sounds to the patient like they have a retinal detachment, or saying that they have white without pressure could mean to them they have a tumor in their eye. I mean, they have no idea, and it's all scary. So I try to minimize the kind of doctor-like banter when I'm in the room with the families, and just try to keep it more layperson, kind of more at their level, so that they kind of understand the gist of it, rather than getting bogged down with all the scary details and terminology.
Yeah, no, that's such great advice and really applicable to the management of adults too, who come despondent and afraid and maybe they're on their, they've already had three or four surgeries and they're coming to you for their next opinion and, just being able to have, as you said, an honest conversation about things, but hopefully to create some silver lining. I think that's a really good way of putting it. And sometimes even if they don't elect to go forward with surgery, just having that conversation alone can be therapeutic for patients and for family members. So no, that's really, really great advice. Well, one area where there wasn't a whole lot of treatment is in the area of inherited retinal disease. And then there's now it's sort of a hotbed of research. And of course, you were on the front lines of the Luxturna trials, and now you've done now what more Luxturna injections than anybody now the, in
I think maybe since approval in the US, yes, we've done I think 41 patients with Luxturna. So 50 total gene therapy patients. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that the remarkable thing I remember when that data first came out was, the goal was just stability, right? And actually there was improvement that was achieved. And so tell us a little bit about first of all what that's like to have, to be involved in a child being able to, see things for the first time and that change in their lives and in their families' lives, but also kind of tell us about how these kids are doing, what the long-term outcomes have been.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, of course. I think in our lifetimes as retina specialists, the approval of Luxturna was one of the one of the biggest breakthroughs. And unfortunately, there hasn't been anything since that's been FDA approved in all this time. Since end of 2017, when this got approved, unfortunately. But yeah, it's quite remarkable, especially in the younger patients. And I would say that the older patients, so I've also treated a number of adults, and I'd say the adults don't quite get the same benefit. The younger patients, it's almost biblical, the stories that parents will relay. And unfortunately, it's so hard to capture that in like an objective way, in the scientific way that we are used to in the clinic, because their visual acuity may not be that different, and we can't measure that much in a kid. But then the stories that the families and the moms and dads will tell you are just kind of like, they can't even you couldn't make this up. I mean, I have kids who have seen their shadow for the first time, who are biking at dusk, who can go trick-or-treating, who can do July 4th, who saw a cloud for the first time, who saw a bird flying for the first time. They'd only seen birds like on the ground around them, but they couldn't like make out a bird like kind of in the sky. So it's just like, it's amazing, or like one of them clearly went to the LA Zoo before their surgery, because they fly in a few days before. Totally uninterested at the exhibits, because like they couldn't see the animals back there, like the lions and stuff are kind of like far away. And then afterwards, they could actually, like, they're pointing at stuff. So it was pretty amazing. And unfortunately, the vision we get in the clinic is kind of the same. It doesn't really, for some reason, there's a disconnect I've found in terms of what we measure in terms of vision and what they're actually doing in the real world. So I guess vision is complicated. But yeah, you have some amazing stories. Whereas adults, they're either hoping for stability, which they're happy about, or they might get some improvements in their kind of peripheral vision and their kind of night vision. So several of them have, noticed like their the smoke alarms, the lights on the smoke alarms on their ceiling, which they never saw before. They never knew that there were lights on the smoke alarms, or like they see their microwave clock for the first time. They never saw that before. Or like they're in a car at night, and instead of it being like totally just black, they can actually see that there's like cars around and there's lights and things, which is kind of cool. But again, it's not the same as these kind of miracle stories of that the kids will experience. So it makes sense, that this is a gene therapy, so it still requires for the cells to be there to express the gene and to function. So if the cells are already gone, then you're not going to get as much of a benefit. So I've always been a big believer since approval of treating really as young as possible. And there were several sites that were kind of maybe hesitant to do that, in part because we can't really measure what the pre-op vision is or post-op vision is in those cases. And also, as you know, like just the vitreoretinal complications might be greater in a younger patient. But I think it's been important to kind of, push the boundaries there and try to get these patients treated as soon as possible while they have the most viable retina, because I think in the long run that's going to benefit them.
And 12 months is the earliest, right? Children can get their
Yeah, like the
therapy.
label, well, it says, greater than 12 months. The youngest patient I've treated, I think, was 20 months of age. I've treated a few under the age of 2. But usually there's just a delay in diagnosis, unfortunately, and so many of these patients, like, they get diagnosed with autism and are getting MRIs. They can't figure out what's going on, because it when they're young like that, you look in their eyes and it looks normal. So you kind of have to rely on cues that a little bit of nystagmus maybe, or the parents really giving you the history of nyctalopia. That'll give you the tip off. I had a grandmother who brought in her three grandchildren. She had been to many doctors and fought for the appointment to see me. And I looked in their eyes. They were like 20/25 vision, and a pretty good vision. But the grandma was just insisting that no, there's something wrong. Like, they can't see at night. And I was like, okay, I believe you. And we did the testing, and it was RPE65. And so actually Univision did like a story on her. They went out and interviewed her and her family. But it's really important to keep in mind that these cases can be subtle initially, and it can be difficult to pick up. So early, it's not just early diagnosis, but early molecular diagnosis and, getting genetic testing done in these patients so that they can, get to surgery as soon as possible.
Right. And gosh, that really speaks to the importance of listening to patients, listening to their parents and family members, and in this case grandmother. That's an amazing story. You mentioned genetics and genetic testing, and this really there's a lot of ways to perform genetic testing, but your program at CHLA really is quite robust. I mean, there's multiple divisions, multiple people involved. Can you tell us a little bit about how you manage this program at CHLA?
Yeah, we're very fortunate. We have the hospitals invested in a what they call Center for Personalized Medicine. It's basically like a genomics center, like kind of like a pathology lab that does genetic testing in-house, which many academic centers have had and they've kind of abandoned because it's a tough proposition financially, because the margins on this the tests are expensive. The margins are slim. There's always new, machines and technology that you have to buy. So it's not exactly like a money maker. You're just hoping at least to break even. But of course, if you can have it, then it's a great resource, because I can order all the tests on my own patients and have it done in-house and be able to literally call up our molecular pathologist, Ryan Schmidt, who pick up the phone and I can ask him, what he thinks about a certain the variant he called and whether it's more pathogenic or not and really have that conversation or get some advice as to what to do with a kind of less conclusive result, because that's something that's so difficult. If you're like a VR surgeon in practice and you get like a VUS or you're not sure whether this is a real variant that can cause the disease, like who are you going to call like to get advice on that? You're busy and it's difficult, so it's nice to just have that in-house. So there have been several times that we've had a result that was maybe not as like tidied up as we'd want, and so I can easily just call them and get advice on that. So the backstory on this is that, of course, it's one thing to just say, oh, my patient has this or that, who cares? But if you're going to subject them to bilateral subretinal gene therapy surgery, you better be damn sure that's the right gene, right? Because it's not going to work if it's a different gene. And so we've had cases where they've had single gene testing. It was just RPE65 tested for, and we'll just retest and send a panel with all the genes so that we can really make sure that's still the main candidate. We will retest if there's any sort of like concern. There was even one case where we collaborated with a basic scientist, Mike Redmond, who basically recreated the mutation in vitro to show that the enzyme was like defective before treating her, because it was like a VUS and it wasn't like an officially pathogenic mutation. So that was just like a one-off, and we published it in JAMA Ophthalmology. But it just shows like maybe the lengths you should go to really make sure that you're operating on the correct premise. And of course, we always test the both parents when possible, to make sure that they're each carriers of one of the variants, and that confirms that it's truly biallelic, that it's truly autosomal recessive.
Right. So you're involved in other gene therapy research, maybe other clinical trials. What are you involved in right now, and kind of where do you view the future in this space going?
Yeah, well, when we started out, there was also a bunch of other clinical trials for gene therapy, and it was just seemed like when Luxturna got approved, it was just obvious that there'd be a bunch of others, because there were many programs that had the basic general same idea, which was viral vector, strong promoter, gene of interest, and subretinal delivery, like should work. Like we're just doing the same thing as Luxturna, so it should get approved. But unfortunately, there have been several kind of stumbles in the field, even in genes that we thought should work or could work. And it gets to your point about like the stability versus improvement that you mentioned earlier. All these trials are going for like a FDA approved like improvement in the vision or the visual behavior, for example, with the maze test that many of you are probably familiar with, not stability. So the stability is not like an endpoint, even though patients would just love to keep what they have and not lose any more of it, because they've seen their vision deteriorate, especially on a 5 year to 5 year basis. But even on an annual basis, they might see that their vision is going down. So they love a stability, but that's not how these trials are being set up. The endpoints are being set up for an improvement. So that's kind of like an internal debate right now, I think, in the field, is in terms of endpoints and what should we be expecting? Because Luxturna might be kind of a rare example of a or RPE65 might be a rare example of a disease where you kind of have relatively preserved structure, and with restoration of the gene, the function can improve remarkably to the point where you have like a drastic delta, like improvement in the function. But there's many others where there's been a lot of accompanying cell loss, so you might not get that sort of like bump or improvement, or the areas of damage are kind of in more critical areas, or for whatever reason, you don't get that kind of improvement. And so it's a real, setback for the field and for the patients when you have gene therapies that work, for example, like let's say they improve, two lines of vision, but not three lines of vision, and then they don't get approved. That, it's unfortunate. But yeah, so we have a couple of clinical trials and are gearing up for more. We're onboarding a few more, but we've been really involved in the Myra Janssen RPGR, X-linked retinitis pigmentosa trial. So RPGR is the most common gene associated with X-linked retinitis pigmentosa. These tend to be older patients. Many won't really even be symptomatic until maybe mid-teens or even early 20s. But it's a kind of a classic sort of RP sort of picture. And so we're excited to see what the results are. We're already getting to 1 year follow-ups on the deferred arm, so the control arm who had to wait a year. So I haven't heard anything, so I don't know like what's happening, but hopefully that could potentially be like a second approved gene therapy if things look good. And then we're also working on Atsina's X-linked retinoschisis trial. So that's kind of interesting to us as VR surgeons, because that's one of those conditions where we try not to go in the eye. It's kind of a nasty situation when not just the vitreous is stuck onto the retina, but also the retina is very like wanting to split apart as you're peeling vitreous off or doing anything. But actually, I think surgeons, including us, we've treated two patients. Have been pleasantly surprised, at least with the inclusion exclusion criteria for this trial, that the surgical aspects are not daunting in any way, and there seem to be good anatomic improvements, and the company's shown that publicly at meetings where you have, including our patients, where you have clear like collapse of the scesis cavities. And pretty remarkably, you look at their fellow eye and there's just still scesis, foveal scesis. So that's kind of cool to like see that, in action. I think the field was hoping that more of these kind of Luxturna-like gene therapy strategies would come through, but I think it's been slower than expected. And then there's a whole slew of genes that can't be approached in that way, just because the genes are so long that they just don't fit into the vectors. So hopefully, and there are some companies like Avant-Garde, and others who are working on strategies to avoid that using other creative ways, either by splicing the RNA or doing other things to kind of get this long, mRNA delivered to the cells appropriately. And there might even be some approaches that don't require gene therapy or for example, don't require viral vectors. So there's these virus-like particles that don't require a virus or lipid nanoparticles to allow delivery. And maybe even like gene agnostic approaches to kind of restore vision in some way, through optogenetics or other things to kind of, bypass, the badness that's happening essentially in the retina.
Right. Well, it's an incredibly exciting time to certainly be a retina specialist in general, but I imagine being in this space in pediatric retina and involved in work in inherited retinal diseases, which we've really had nothing to offer. Now there's, as you said earlier, there's a silver lining, there's some hope here, and really exciting and great work that you've been doing.
Yeah, and actually going back to like our conversation before, when I was in training, I spoke to several like mentors and told them, I want to do gene therapy, and these were like VR people, and they were like, no, don't do that, that you don't want to be like a dystrophy person, you don't want to be like that, like the medical retina types or whatever. And I kind of like ignored them, and I'm glad I did because, as you know, now it's, one of the hottest parts of our field, I think, and one of the, it's amazing to think that our tiny field, which is just a sliver of the human body, is almost at the forefront of this like scientific breakthrough, along with like maybe cancer and some other, fields. So it's like it's pretty remarkable, like, to be in that space, kind of leading the way for all of medicine.
Absolutely. I mean, look, the eye is a very special, it's a privileged place. And so it's really amazing work. And the things that we never thought would be possible, or maybe it was a bit far-fetched, 20 years ago or so, and now we're really starting to bear fruit. And so I think as this is occurring, there's probably a lot more interest in getting involved in pediatric retina. Maybe people who are ophthalmologists, general ophthalmology residents, or their retina fellows, maybe they're interested in doing something more within pediatrics. And there's a lot of programs, our programs included, that offer a robust pediatric experience. And there's some programs that are sort of historically like the place to go to learn how to do pediatric retina. There was an interesting article, I think, in the most recent issue of Retina Times about whether or not there should be a pediatric retina fellowship. Like, should that be something separate, right? Talked about, oncology fellowships and, some sort of sub specialty fellowships. And so what's your take on that topic?
I feel like at the very least, you should go to an institution where you have like a mentor on site, who's seasoned, who can kind of guide you on your like initial cases. I don't think you need a separate fellowship, and the reason is that it's still the same techniques, it's the same, it's VR surgery. But whereas us being used to maybe always going 3.5 millimeters back for our trocar insertions, that could totally change, depending on the size of the eye, the age of the patient. That's just the most simple example. But for example, showed a case this week of persistent fetal vasculature, avoiding the pars plicata, pars plana altogether, and going through the cornea to make it safe. What to do, what not to do. And one of the things I found helpful is, when I wasn't sure, is kind of running these cases by Tom before I do them. And I would essentially, so I'd be like, I have a PFE case or a fever case, and he was great in that he would give me, his like top three worst things that ever happened to him, on that diagnosis before, which is like, okay, I'm not going to do that. I'm not, don't tug on like the ciliary processes, don't tug on the capsule, don't do this, live to fight another day, because as sometimes you can think you're doing something right until you make a big mistake, and then you'll never make that mistake again, but you can save yourself a lot of grief just kind of avoiding that mistake from the beginning. And so it's those sort of like, what are the guardrails on these sort of cases, what to do, what not to do, and how to start, how to end, what are the goals of the surgery. That's all you kind of need to know. You kind of just have to have that framework in mind going into these cases. The actual technique is basically the same. I mean, you're still doing vitrectomy, you're still using the same instruments. We're not using, different instruments for the most part. So I think that's important. It's just, and you don't and that person doesn't even need to be with you in the OR. It's just, you just have to, what I like to do, and I don't know if you do the same thing, is kind of mentally run through a surgery in your mind before you do it, like a new surgery. Like before I did gene therapy, I'd maybe done a few subretinal tPAs as a fellow, but never, that was all on detached retina. There was hemorrhage, and you could just stick the cannula in. It was a matter of just kind of imagining what I would do, run through different scenarios, kind of be mentally prepared for anything, think of like what could go wrong, what I'll do if like some if I can't do this or that. And so it's kind of the same thing with these new approaches or conditions where you're not really sure what you're going to encounter, but kind of having in mind, like, what not to do, what could go wrong, how to start the case, when to end the case and how to end the case, I think are more important than anything else.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And having that mental preparation is important. Now with, more and more videos being available to be able to watch other surgeons do it, and then that's a huge benefit. And also, as you said, having a good mentor, a friend, that could be somebody from your training, that could be somebody that you work with. It could be just a professional colleague who's across the country or around the world, but having somebody who has more experience and who can be a sounding board, I think can be really beneficial for obviously for surgical outcomes, but just for general professional growth. I think it's important to have those types of people in your lives.
Right. No, I think I hope that and it's nice to have someone at your institution, but I think especially in pediatric retina, it's a relatively tight-knit community and we're all kind of helpful and available to others. And I recently got a call from a former trainee who was having difficulty during a surgery, and just kind of giving advice based on my own experience, I think was just very helpful, because you kind of, if you're in a situation for the first time, you kind of don't know, you don't have a crystal ball as to how it's going to end up, but at least hearing, that you do this or that and everything will be okay, it's just, makes a big difference. So absolutely. And I think that's what our mentors taught us, is that, academics is, and just medical field in general, it's all about the people, right? It's about, having a friend to call, someone to kind of run a case by, when you're in trouble or when you're not in trouble, just to kind of have that support system.
Yeah, and so it's really the best part of the entire part of being a doctor. I mean, aside the pa patient being with patients on their journey is by far the best part of it. But for me, a close second is definitely the people and the relationship. So, and you're one of them, Aaron. So thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us. A lot of really valuable pearls and great lessons for me and also for all of our viewers. So thank you so much, and we'll have you back for more interesting videos in the future.
Thank you so much. This was such a wonderful thing to do. Thank you all.
Thanks, Aaron.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.